Getting to break down public policy with Tom Piatek, contributing editor to Chronicles Magazine, also writes for Talkies Magazine and the American Conservative. We talked about some points here before the break, a little bit on economics, industrial policy, etc. You've written, at least, I don't want to necessarily put words in your mouth, but at least somewhat approvingly of the way the government handled the GM situation. Certainly you've said that it was better not to have let GM go out of business. And that's one of those gray areas, it seems to me, because there's that. I have to admit, I was basically in favor of TARP, not the second version of it. I was hopeful the first one would have passed. They larded up the second one with pork to try to get it through. But, you know, there are times when public policy forces you to make bad choices, and these are things I don't think that are representative of what too many people stand for, maybe the neocons at their core. But there are some things that have been done that have been regrettable, but maybe to stave off collapse. That's how I've seen anything that I've wanted to swallow, that I've had to swallow even reluctantly. How do you see what the government did with GM?
Well, there, I mean, I was outspoken because, you know, I have family connections to the auto industry. I have some understanding of it. And part of the reason I wrote about it was simply because I didn't see anyone making very few people on the right making a case in favor of the American auto industry. And a lot of the criticisms I thought were unfair were quite old. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the GM, and there was just a survey this week from another independent organization where the two top rated brands were Lincoln, a Ford brand, and Buick, a General Motors brand. I mean, the quality of American cars is equal to the quality of German and Japanese cars, and in fact is probably better than the German cars, and in some cases now better than the Japanese cars. So I thought a lot of the criticism was unfair and dated, and part of it was a regional basis. I mean, I'm from the industrial Midwest. You know, this area still has Cleveland's not as dependent as Detroit, but both this area has a large connection with the American auto industry. And my whole life, I've seen my tax dollars go to fund, you know, water projects in the West, military bases in the South. The SNL bailout of the late 80s was basically money pouring out of the industrial Midwest into the Sun Belt. And once our region was implicated in something requiring a little government assistance, we were going to draw a line in the sand and basically destroy the economy of Michigan and severely damage the economy in northern Ohio. That was another reason I wrote about it. But finally, I think it is in the national interest for us to have an auto industry. And it's great that the Japanese and the Germans have established plants in the United States. But the main reason, a major reason they've done that is because they're competing against an American auto industry. They're afraid of protectionism. They want to have a toehold in the market. And there was an interview in the Wall Street Journal. There's a story in the Wall Street Journal in 07, I believe, so before any of this was on the horizon, talking to a unnamed Toyota executive saying, you know, it's much more profitable for us now to build all of our cars in Japan and ship them to the United States if it wasn't for all the political problems that would cause. So the political problems, of course, would be we're competing against an American industry, and if we pull our production back to Japan, you know, maybe we'll have to face some protectionist measures from Congress. So it's good that the Japanese and the Germans have established plants here, but we need to remember the reason they've done it is because they're competing against an American auto industry. And if that auto industry disappears, foreign investment will decline. I'm not saying it'll go away entirely. It'll certainly decline. And the final point that I think is in the interest, related to our national interest, is the American auto companies do their research and development here. They spend a lot of money on research and development. They do their engineering here. They do their high-level work here, whereas the foreign companies still generally do that overseas. And it's vitally important to us to maintain a strong technological base. And the engineering profession in the United States has been hurt by the fact that our manufacturing is not protected, and engineering has always been intimately connected with manufacturing. It's also hurt by immigration. We have the H-1B visa program where you can bring in engineers and computer programmers from abroad. That drives down the wages of engineering. So as a consequence, I know many, I'm actually a lawyer, But I know many lawyers, and you know, when their kids are going to college and they're thinking about careers, the advice that they're giving their children is don't consider engineering, because it's viewed as something that's offshoreable, something that will go overseas, something that doesn't have job security. And so people who have the natural aptitude to be engineers are choosing to become lawyers or go to Wall Street instead. And that's just not a formula for long-term success. So there are definitely lots of problems associated with the auto bailout. But I think there were arguments in favor of it, and those were the arguments I made.
Well, you know, it's really kind of frightening for the future of the country, what you've said about I hadn't really heard that about engineering and the prospect of people staying out of that business potentially, that because we certainly need those type of skills going forward as a country. In terms of, and you've identified as well, you know, this Midwestern area that we live in, and using that as an example for these industrial policies and everything, I see it where, again, to me, there's a great untapped potential silent majority, not to use a Nixon term here, but people out there who understand, who relate to these issues, even if they're, you know, largely apolitical in their lives. I mean, everybody reaches points where they're really PO'd about stuff and they start paying attention, whether it be after a 9/11, whether it be in the midst of an economic downturn, whatever. I've had kind of an ongoing little debate going here. One of our recurring guests has been a gentleman named Colin Delaney from epolitics.com. Great site. Colin, I'd classify him as being a thoughtful liberal, so we always have some good conversations back and forth. I've said to him, I really believe, as a paleocon, that it is something where way more people really are that without realizing that. I've held up my own friends as an example of that. A lot of my friends, you know, my college friends are all fairly political. They're the guys that I did stuff with in college politically, but a lot of my other friends are largely apolitical, and yet if you ask them where they stood on stuff, I think they're largely with me. And I've kind of held that up as an example. He says, well, it's the chicken or the egg. You know, you've gravitated towards people who are kind of like you. So do you tend to agree with me on this, that there are a lot of people that think like you and I, even if they don't exactly necessarily categorize it that way overtly?
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think you can see that by looking at opinion polls on a lot of these issues. As I've, you know, immigration, it's certainly overwhelmingly the paleo conservative position. You know, it's time to restrict immigration. I mean, in fact, at a time with high unemployment, where even according to the official government statistics, which some have argued are understate the problem, last November, the 20% of men between 29 and 54 were unemployed. So at a time of high unemployment, what sense does it possibly make to import people into this country to compete for those jobs with Americans? It makes no sense at all. That's an issue where the public is with us. A willingness to re-examine trade policy is another issue where the public is with us. The public is certainly more conservative on social issues than is the leadership of either party. So I do think that if you look at the individual issues, a lot of paleo-conservative positions are popular. And people are frankly, you know, there's certainly war fatigue with respect to both Iraq and Afghanistan. So, I mean, those are all issues where our positions are more popular with the public than you would gather by looking at how people vote in Washington or what most talking heads talk about on TV.
As far as something that was referenced in the column that I put up over the weekend, in terms of opportunities for daylight for any of this agenda actually poking through, do you share any of my optimism, or at least my sense that it's kind of now or never, everything with the Tea Party here, with the willingness to, it seems to me, re-examine a lot of these concepts as people are kind of going back to basics on a lot of this kind of stuff? Frankly, if it doesn't happen in the next couple of years, I'm left wondering what the next opportunity would be. But it seems like there are enough people who, in the movement, who are legitimately committed to basic constitutional principles, that it seems to me like that might be the way to kind of edge in there and at least try and gain some measure of parity with the neocons and the Republican Party.
Well, I certainly think that the Tea Party offers a great potential because it is a popular movement that is not really directed, centrally directed. I mean, the problem, you know, we have, frankly, is that the sort of people in the media or on the national political stage who share our views, there's not a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're going to hear as national figures seeing this popular movement and attach themselves to it is not what we're talking about here tonight. But the flip side of that is if these issues do indeed have a great deal of popularity, at some point a politician interested in advancing his career is going to pick up the issues and run with them.
As far as any potential politicians that could advance these policies, let's go to one of the biggest hot-button politicians out there, that being Sarah Palin. And I'm curious to get your thought on this. It seems to me to be, I've seen two schools of thought on her on the paleocon side. I have to say that those of you guys in the paleocon media, I'm seeing probably more people who are more or less against her, have been kind of suspicious of her from the beginning because, again, she has tended to talk in a lot of these kind of buzzwords, has kind of tended to at least have this anti-intellectual air of a George W. Bush. Perhaps I was a little bit too much of an optimist, and I was actually familiar with her before she came on the scene. It kind of followed her in Alaska. I liked what I saw as the populist streak of her. I mean, she took on big oil up there, it seemed to me, to a large extent. She was outside the Republican establishment. A willingness to be populist in a real sense, I think if you're not willing to take that step, there's no chance that you're even going to be a paleocon. I've been kind of clinging to that over time. And then the last couple months, I'm just looking at these increasingly militaristic noises coming from her, and she's sounding more and more like Mitt Romney every day, who I truly loathe. Mitt Romney makes me physically ill, and she's sounding more like him every day. Where do you come down on her, and have you had basically the same kind of opinion of her over time?
Well, I was very optimistic, after hearing her tremendous speech at the Republican convention. I mean, it was a great speech. But unfortunately, since that time, I think she's shown signs that she's, not ready yet for the national stage. And I think the Republicans, did her no favors by the way they handled her as vice president. Pat Buchanan, after she was selected, said basically the thing to do is keep her away from the national media. And instead, they chose to feed her to the wolves. And that was not a very wise choice. And I think right now she is definitely in foreign policy. She's getting some very bad advice, which is diminishing her appeal. So I initially was optimistic about her. I thought she was a breath of fresh air. I'm less optimistic today.
I'm almost wondering if this is a redux, and if so, it's a very bad thing, whether she would get nominated or even get elected here. I mean, George W. Bush, when he was running for president, we all remember the talk, I think it was in one of the debates, of a humble foreign policy, and then Bill Kristol kind of got out the pocket watch and hypnotized him, and then after 9/11, things went in a different direction here. The fact that and Bill Kristol's been on her bandwagon from the very beginning, and I mean even before she was nominated for VP in 08, and that maybe should have given me the creeps a long time ago if I had really reflected on it. But is history repeating itself here with a lot of the quote unquote intellectuals of that side really kind of wooing her?
I think so, and I don't know that they, they're hedging their bets. I think they saw that she potentially could be something very different, and they wanted to make sure that she wasn't. So I do think that, and they definitely have influenced her in a number of unfavorable ways.
That is very unfortunate if that ends up being the case, because as you said, there really is a lack of any type of significant counterbalancing force as far as it goes with public policy. Ron Paul is, of course, commonly associated with the paleocons in large measure. In many ways, he's more of a true libertarian. He is conservative on the social issues, though, so I guess he would be described as the social conservative libertarian, which I don't know exactly how that differs from paleo conservatism. He seems to be maybe a little bit more isolationist on foreign policy than your typical paleocon. But I mean, Ron Paul and his son, who it looks like I think is going to be the next senator in the state of Kentucky. I mean, they're about as close as it gets, save for the stray congressman who makes some noises here and there, right?
Well, yeah, I think Ron Paul is a libertarian. He's not a paleo conservative. Mm-hmm. He's certainly is committed to free trade, although he's been opposed to some of the free trade. I mean, he was opposed to NAFTA. He was opposed to GATT from a different standpoint. So in terms of rethinking American, as you put it, industrial policy, we wouldn't get that from Ron Paul. On foreign policy, he's quite a bit closer. I think he is. I think you're right. I don't know if I he's a little more. He goes a little more to the non-interventionist side than you know, certainly someone like Pat Buchanan does. But I think he's fairly close, and I think it would be a good thing if his son was elected senator from Kentucky to give at least a different perspective in the United States Senate.
Oh, yeah. I don't think you need any more evidence of that than the way that Dick Cheney was mobilizing against him in the Senate primary there, and talking about what a bad thing it would be to have him as a voice in the Senate there. I think that tells you everything you need to know positive about Rand Paul. On the nature of libertarians and of building alliances and everything, I mean, we've obviously seen a lot in the last year and a half here with the Obama administration of common cause kind of being made between the paleocons and the libertarians. As you point out, there are some differences, whether it be on issues like trade. Ron Paul, being a socially conservative libertarian, is definitely in the minority. Unfortunately, it seems to me, from a kind of pessimistic point of view, these are the kind of things where it looks like it's high tide for that common cause here, particularly if the tide ends up sweeping out Obama, the Democratic Congress, whatever. It seems to me, as you get, even if it were a true paleoconservative administration in there, there probably would be some things that would happen that would cause the libertarians to peel off, whether it be, you know, appointment of another Judge Alito or anybody like that. So am I wrong to think that this is probably just about the peak of that moment?
Well, I think the thing is that, you know, libertarians are committed to an ideology. You know, paleoconservatives at least claim, you know, not to be committed to an ideology. And so the libertarian view, I mean, there's an answer to every question that's, you know, really not based on empirical evidence. It's based on ideological presuppositions. And because of that, I think the problem with coalition building with libertarians is that if you deviate any way from their ideology, they're going to end up attacking you. And that, unfortunately, that's what happened to Pat Buchanan in his 96 campaign. He originally had some libertarian support. They ended up not liking his trade policy and, you know, really going after him. I think paleoconservatives have been, generally speaking, have been a lot more hospitable to Ron Paul than libertarians were to Pat Buchanan. And I think the reason for that is that libertarians are ideologues, and if you deviate from their ideology, it doesn't matter if you agree with them on 9 out of the other 10 issues. They're going to focus on the one issue where you disagree, and that's going to cause problems. So I hope I'm not being unduly pessimistic, but that's how I see things.
Well, I think you're exactly right, and I think the point about the paleocons having more open arms toward Ron Paul than the libertarians did to Pat Buchanan is right. For as much of a grudge as I bear against the neocons, the Republican establishment, everything for everything they did to Pat Buchanan, you are, of course, right to remind us that the libertarians had a piece of that as well. And as far as somebody who might perhaps put the libertarian label on him, but he's put a lot of labels on himself over the years here. I was telling you during the break, I'm a great admirer of the takedowns that you have done of the very tiresome Christopher Hitchens, who right now is, you know, on pretty much a sympathy tour at the moment here, as he has cancer that it looks like it might well be fatal. And, you know, while, again, I won't go so far as to say that I wish it on him, because that's just bad karma. I try not to do that. You know, I did say during the break to you, too, that, I mean, it might make me a bad person. I can't bring myself to pray for his conversion on this. I feel like he deserves to see what's on the other side and to reap it for everything that he's done in the course of his life. That's, of course, that's not something I can really defend, but that's just my gut position on the man. But again, you've done a lot to kind of lay bare all these things. The National Review crowd and everybody else, all the neocons, as much as they want to clutch him to their bosom, we forget everything, or they forget. I haven't forgotten. You haven't forgotten. Everything you wrote about Mother Teresa, Ronald Reagan, we could go on down the line about what a loathsome life and career this man has had. And now at this moment, again, I don't think it's unchristian of us to talk about the full record of everything he's done.
No, and I think, I mean, the reason I started writing about Hitchens, I think he's an interesting figure. Number one, he's a very good writer, so I enjoy reading his stuff even when I disagree with it. But he's an interesting figure because he's been embraced by the neoconservatives, and where they, you know, these are people that believe in drawing political lines, saying so-and-so is outside the pale. So someone who hates God, who hates Christianity, who wrote a vicious obituary of Ronald Reagan, calling him, I can't remember the exact quote, something along the lines of a stupid lizard.
Mm-hmm.
Saying about Mother Teresa on the air and repeating it because he thought it was so clever, I wish there was a hell for the bitch to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Having one of his heroes as Leon Trotsky, referring to Lenin as a great man, one of whose great accomplishments in Hitchens' view was what he did to the Russian Orthodox Church, which, of course, was murderous, violent suppression. They have no problem with this person because he agrees with them on the need to have war, the United States wage war in the Middle East. So they're willing to overlook all these other things to embrace Hitchens, which tells us that that's their core commitment. Everything else they talk about is secondary. When I heard Hitchens had cancer, I said a little prayer for his recovery and conversion, just as I would if I heard about anyone else having a serious illness. But, you know, his own record is of defaming the dead, being vicious toward the dead, of people that he did not like. He's not one who's shown much mercy or compassion for those who disagree with him. And the sycophancy that he's receiving in some quarters now is truly nauseating when you consider his record. I mean, he has done everything in his power to undermine traditional morality, traditional values, Christianity, and none of this makes any difference to the neocons, because when they speak in favor of those things, they're just paying lip service at best, and their embrace of Hitchens is the clearest example of their hypocrisy on all those issues.
Very well said. And I have a friend who unfortunately is an admirer of Hitchens. He said he was probably going to be listening tonight. I hope he was listening right there at that point in time. None of that can be refuted. National Review, I'll tell you what, if there were real truth in advertising, you know, I think it would say on the masthead, everything is negotiable except permanent war. You know, that seems to be their point of view.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And it's, you know, the bottom line is that our country, unfortunately, and in a real sense, is broke. We cannot afford to be the world's policeman. You know, going into Afghanistan to get rid of al-Qaeda after the Taliban refused to turn bin Laden over, I think overwhelmingly Americans supported. That made sense. That was one war. The war we're fighting now to bring human rights to Afghanistan is a totally different war. It's nation building. It's a leftist social experiment. It's not something for which Americans should die, and it's not something that Americans who have our own very serious economic problems should pay for.
It's one of those things. It just strikes me as being weird because, you know, you mentioned that about it as being a leftist social experiment. I remember in the 90s being opposed to Clinton's Kosovo war. And my own brother calling me an isolationist at the time for saying that. But, you know, it's one of these things, and I don't know if it's in the DNA of the left or whatever the case may be, but it almost seems like war is good so long as it doesn't serve the American national interest. They'll be opposed to anything that they think is being waged on behalf of the U.S. of A. But for something like that, you know, as you said, with Afghanistan, you know, that this has basically become a social project. Kosovo, I'm sorry, you can't. On humanitarian grounds, you could find a million different things to go in there and support that. But you can find atrocities that happen in Africa that we don't care about because they don't have oil or other places like that. It just seems like the left, you know, as soon as they find something that doesn't involve us in any way, they're all for it.
Well, and to cite Hitchens as an example, I mean, that's what led him to change his mind. I mean, he had been an opponent of every Cold War measure to defend the United States. But what changed his mind about the American military is he saw that it could be used to fight what he terms fascism around the globe. And we could harness the American military for leftist ends. And he was all in favor of that. And that's basically what the neocons have done. I mean, why do we want, who cares what the internal social policies are in the Middle East? That is not in the vital interest of the United States. John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State, President, said, America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. That's a sensible policy. That's in line with the policy of George Washington. That's in line with the policy of Thomas Jefferson. That's not in line with our current foreign policy. If you remember George Bush's second inaugural address, It was his goal was to end evil throughout the planet. A truly insane policy whose only result could be the bankruptcy of the United States. But this sort of stuff, thanks to the neocons, is now widespread, not only on the left, but on the right in the United States. We're starting to run up against reality, starting to realize that, you know, we can't end evil in the United States. We can't end evil around the world, and we shouldn't be trying. But I think we're learning from experience now.
We are. I think everything is kind of swinging our way, albeit relatively slowly. I do think the wind is at our back as far as these things. To bring everything full circle and on a little bit of a nicer note here. Well, actually, I guess compared to the ills of the world at large, anything would be nicer. But I wanted to. The nicer thing I would say would be about to put over your column. I thought your column about LeBron James recently in Chronicles, Cleveland sports, everything we've had to go through. It's one of those things where, again, as we discussed off air, you know, if you don't live here, didn't grow up here, you just don't get it. It's one of those things. I myself had written a couple columns, mostly for therapeutic purposes after it was done. And I came to the conclusion, what I found ultimately most galling in the entire episode is that it seemed to me to be sort of emblematic of the pathology of the deadbeat dad, in the sense that you come in, you have an organization completely under your thumb for 7 years, the implicit blackmail of keep me happy or I will be gone. And then in the end, you're gone anyways. That's just, I think that kind of kick in the teeth, that kind of conduct over the course of time and the implicit promise that in response for giving me everything I want, putting my boys on the payroll, everything like that, and in the end, you just spit in the face anyways.
Oh, yeah, no, it was, I think it's at this point I'm more sad than angry, and I think LeBron is going to find out there's no place like home. I mean, he enjoyed unconditional support because he was seen as a hometown boy. And, he gave every sign of understanding the history of Cleveland sports, the fact that we haven't won a championship since 1964. We've had a lot of heartbreak since then. And he's not going to get that in Miami. I mean, he's not going to be the king of the town there the way he was here. He's going to find that out. But I thought it was interesting to write about, not just because of LeBron, but I think sports is interesting. I think it can be, very healthy because you learn about loyalty by, rooting for your hometown teams and by sticking to them through adversity. And that's certainly something we know about in Cleveland. And it also shows the limits of ideology. I mean, it turns out if you look at sports from the perspective of a fan, the free market is not always right. Free agency for players has been a disaster for fans. It's inflated player salaries. It's inflated players' egos. It's deprived us of one of the joys where you would be able to watch a player develop in your town and spend his whole career in your town and get to see him develop. And that's largely been taken from us. And of course, it's not just player free agency, it's owner free agency, a la Art Modell moving the Browns to Baltimore. And that was one of the reasons I wrote that. I mean, I grew up in Parma, and I would drive past when we visited my grandmother on Broadview Road. Mike Garcia, the Indians reliever, Indians pitcher from the 50s, had a dry cleaning store. And I knew nothing about Garcia, but my dad pointed that out, told me his career with the Indians. And, he wasn't alone like that. I used to drive past Dante Lavelli's furniture store. My wife went to high school with the children of Lou Groza, who stayed in Cleveland as an insurance agent. It used to be that players would use their time in the spotlight to build goodwill in the towns that they played with the intention of staying in those towns afterwards, oftentimes starting a business. And now I'm afraid they're mercenaries, and they go where they want for the highest dollar. And I don't know that it's probably not good for the soul of the players. It's certainly not good for the fans who enjoy the game.
No, it's a sad state of affairs. And to bring everything full circle, and you referenced Parma, what a tremendous coincidence here that our own Mike Ptak here at FDH and also host of Pro Wrestling Insider on Tuesday nights here on STN and Sports Talk Cleveland. Actually, I went to school back in the day with Tom, mentioned to me the other night when I was talking about the guest lineup that we had for this week. what a just tremendous coincidence. What a small world it is. But Tom, as we mentioned, you know, at the outset here, as far as your writing as a contributing editor with Chronicles Magazine, Takis Magazine, The American Conservative, we always give our guests a chance to plug wholeheartedly on everything here. So take it away on anything about any of those ventures or anything else that the people should know about.
Well, you know, I think, you know, I haven't written for Taki Mag for a while, but, you know, it's a worthwhile venture. I also write for the website VDare. I've written for the American Conservative in the past, but right now I'm a contributing editor of Chronicles. And if you have been interested in or liked anything you've heard tonight, consider subscribing. Go to the website, chroniclesmagazine.org. I sometimes write pieces just for the website, and you can find information on how to subscribe. And I can say without hesitation that it's the best political magazine in the United States, and not because I sometimes write for it. I mean, they do a very good job. So, you know, visit vdare.com, visit takimag.com, subscribe to the American Conservative. But if I could put in a plug, it would be go to www.chroniclesmagazine.org and read the website and subscribe to the magazine.
Exactly. Chronicles, along with a couple of the other sites, among the 2025 links you will find on our FDH Lounge Ultimate Links page here. And again, wholeheartedly recommend going to check those out. I do so an awful lot. And as I look at the front page of Chronicles here, just had a mugshot of, or not mugshot, Freudian slip, their headshot of Pat Buchanan. And Pat Buchanan has been the political figure that I have looked up to probably the most over the course of my life as I've studied these things. And the best thing that I can say, the best way I can characterize our discussion here tonight, Tom, is although I am insanely jealous that you know Pat Buchanan, I find it impossible to hold it against you altogether. It was a tremendous segment with you tonight to talk public policy. I'd certainly look forward to doing it again with you sometime.
Okay, well, Rick, I've enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
This has been outstanding. It's been so great to have you in. Tom Piatek, everybody, it's been tremendous to have him in. Contributing editor at Chronicles Magazine.